Welcome to The Record here on KUOW Seattle right about lunchtime. I'm Bill Radke. Great to have you with us. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Does it seem like there's a lot of restaurants opening in the Seattle area? Interesting new places you want to try, but how will you ever have the time or the money or the traffic patience to try all these restaurants? You are not imagining things. At the Seattle Times, Bethany Jean Clement reports there are more than 2,600 restaurants in the Seattle area, and that's up 25% from a decade ago. And yet, business is not great. Bethany, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Also with us, restaurant owner Brandon Pettit owns Delancey in Ballard and Dino's Tomato Pie in Capitol Hill. Welcome.
Thank you.
So first of all, the number of restaurants. The two of you sat down a moment ago as we're getting our microphones ready, and you're professionals. You, Bethany, you write about this industry. Brandon, you work in this industry, and you were talking like, OMG, like this is bananas. So give us an idea how bananas, what's bananas?
It is completely bananas. I think in the last couple of months, we've seen 40 new openings of restaurants in the Seattle area, and that is consistent with basically what we've been seeing over the last year. It's a lot. As someone who writes about restaurants, I cannot even get to them all. It's nuts.
Yeah, this is your job.
Yeah.
To get to a lot of them.
When I signed a lease on my place, Dino's on Capitol Hill, I had done a calculation that 5 pizzerias could open and they'd all be busy. So I was super excited that I could open. And even if a bunch of places I didn't know about opened, everything would be fine. And then 10 pizzerias opened.
On Capitol Hill.
Yeah. 2 are already out of business. And then there's another one coming in the next few months.
Is there a pizza bubble?
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah. Is there a restaurant bubble in Seattle?
Definitely.
Because you write about there's high, in your piece, you use the phrase high anxiety.
There is high anxiety. I think a lot of chef owners would say they think there's a bubble. I don't know.
I think it's neighborhood based.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So like downtown or Capitol Hill or South Lake Union, where people travel to eat out, there's a major bubble. But like the small neighborhoods, some of them are still underserved, I think.
Well, okay, so downtown Capitol Hill, South Lake Union, people travel there, so you would expect there'd be a lot of restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying even so, there are too many.
Overcompensated, yeah.
Okay.
There weren't enough, and then everybody got the idea at once, including people from out of town. That's why you see like a sizzle pie from Portland. I think there's 3 international chains opening ramen places.
Mm-hmm.
And so people from all over saw how underserved that market was. And then I think we just overcompensated.
And no one wants to drive anywhere for dinner anymore. To go to a restaurant across town is crazy. The traffic is awful. The parking is terrible.
But what about Uber and light rail haven't helped significantly?
I think that helps. But I think there are a lot of people who are going to restaurants in their own neighborhood if they can.
Yeah.
Brandon can speak to that a little bit.
So I have restaurants in 2 different neighborhoods. And in Ballard, I seem to be getting all the positive aspects of a city's growth, like more houses are being built in Ballard, so therefore more customers. Traffic is getting bad, so people are less likely to drive to Capitol Hill or downtown and just stay in their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And then on Capitol Hill, there's tons of construction, which takes away parking. There's terrible traffic, so less people are traveling there. I talked to an Uber driver the other day who said that he used to go back and forth from Bellevue about 12 times an evening, and now he does once or twice. Hmm. And he was saying part of it he thinks it's because of traffic. Part of it is that the East Side is also growing with a bunch of restaurants and bars.
Yeah.
So less of them are coming over to Capitol Hill.
Okay.
There's so many growing pains.
I want to talk about food trends. There will be poke. I want to talk about minimum wage, $15. So let's start, since we've already talked about pizza and ramen, let's talk about food trends, if that's the word. First of all, pizza seems like such beyond a trend, like the granddaddy of all can't miss, that why is there in 2017-ish, why is there a pizza boom?
I think it's just in some ways an overcorrection of having too few places for so long.
There was not enough good pizza in Seattle before.
So there used to be not enough good pizza in general in Seattle. And then there became a boom, which was
what makes a good pizza?
Good ingredients, balanced flavors, just tastes good. So there was there were not enough places in Seattle than there were.
It was cheap, so people were making bad pizza cheaply. But as they say, the bad, worst pizza I ever had was not bad.
Yeah, there just weren't people. It wasn't something people were that interested in making, just super awesome pizza. And that changed. Now there's awesome pizza all over the town. And then Capitol Hill didn't have enough places, and the population was growing. And tons of people saw that, including me and people from Portland, like Sizzle Pie. But then too many people saw that opportunity and just opened 10 restaurants when they needed four.
And it's a price point thing, too. Pizza is less expensive to make and sell and buy for the customer than going out to a real dinner. And I think with...
Did you say pizza's not a real dinner?
Forgive me.
Fancy dinner.
It is. It's a beautiful dinner, and I enjoy it myself a lot.
Okay.
But a full sit-down, you know... I think that we're also,
whole meal deal.
Yeah, we're also seeing ramen and poke, and
and
those are price point related too. One of the things I think chef owners have been seeing in the city is that some of the new residents and maybe some of the old are not as willing to go to a fine dining establishment as they used to be, and that kind of behavior is just sort of unprecedented and super difficult to predict.
Why would that be? That we have not just people here, but we have money. Why would there be less fine dining lately?
It's what the people want. You know, I can't look into their brains, but you know,
let's do it anyway.
Who can
figure out the people?
Younger people who.
Well, the people who were originally on, say, Capitol Hill, are paying almost double in rent what they were a few years ago, so they have less. Extra money.
Right.
And then the new wealthy people who are moving into town, the tech industry, it's very different wealthy people than in the past.
How are the tech wealthy people different when it comes to
younger,
eating?
I think.
Yeah.
I think, like, I would assume people who, like, go to Canlis now are much younger than they were 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's just a different clientele that has the money to go to fine dining.
And we're also seeing a huge rise in food delivery. And, you know, there's a whole spectrum ways for people to eat now. And if you don't want to go out to a nice restaurant, you don't have to. I mean, food can come to you.
Yeah, right. And food trucks,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so first, before we leave tech workers, how do Amazon workers eat? Anybody know?
No one knows.
I have no idea.
Do they?
Nope.
They do eat at trucks a lot.
You write about Amazon pressure in your Seattle Times piece, Bethany.
It's something that chef owners who are trying to operate in South Lake Union talk about a lot. They say that lunch is huge. Lunch business is huge. Happy hour business is booming. And then the crowds just go away.
Hmm.
Go home and order in or go to Capitol Hill. I don't know. I'm not tracking them.
Okay, back to food trends. Pizza, we said. By the way, Brandon, what's your favorite pizza outside of your restaurant?
I like the pizza at Cafe Lago in Montlake. I like pizza at the Masonry.
Bar del Corso.
Bar del Corso is definitely awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What about ramen? Why? I've seen a ramen boom. Although I'm going to get to poke in a minute. Why ramen?
Again, I think it's a price point thing, and it's a speed thing, and it's not challenging, it's not scary, it's soup.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Agree.
Once you learn that it's
a restaurant title. It's not scary, it's soup.
Once you learn that it's okay to slurp, especially, I think people just love soup.
Where is it okay to slurp? In ramen restaurants?
Yes.
Do they say so? Is there a sign, slurping okay?
No, but it is accepted etiquette. In fact, I think it means you're really enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay.
And it's cold and rainy here.
Yeah, soup.
So
right. This
ramen.
Is a good soup
Yay.
Spot. Okay,
yeah.
Ramen. Yeah, pho, ramen. Okay. Poke. I know. I eat it regularly. It tastes very good. And it's healthy. I do it with all the greens as the mm-hmm. without even the rice, you know. And
Seaweed.
Seaweed, absolutely. Furikake and all that stuff. But why 30, what did you say, 35 poke places suddenly?
I think it was around that number.
Why do things crest like that?
Because there's no overarching organization to any of it. I mean,
35 new ones, by the way, not 35 restaurants in the Seattle area.
Within the last year, year and a half.
Yeah.
So dozens and dozens of people are seeing, oh, you know, poke is a thing, and people are eating it, and people get the same idea at the same time, and then it's just bananas. I mean,
yeah.
It's
because when you sign, like in my experience, when you sign a lease, you do all this research on what a neighborhood can handle, but you don't know, you can't know that next week five other places are going to do the same thing.
How do you research?
Look at places,
yeah.
You can look at permits that are already available and things that people who have decided before you sign the lease that they're going to open in that neighborhood, but you can't know that, like I couldn't have known that a month later Sizzle Pie would open the same neighborhood from Portland, or that Italian Family Pizza was going to move up from Pioneer Square. There's just no way to predict that.
Again, Brandon Pettit owns Delancey in Ballard and Dino's Tomato Pie in Capitol Hill. Bethany Jean Clement writes about the city's food and restaurant scene for the Seattle Times. You said something about researching. How do you research what kind of restaurant to put in a neighborhood? Is it just financial, or are you going around door to door and saying, what do you crave?
For me, it's more personal. Like, I opened my first place when I was in Portland one day, eating at a place called Ken's Artisan Pizza. And I was thinking, like, Seattle really needs a place like this. I wish I had a place in Ballard that I could eat at that was just like this restaurant. They should open in Seattle. And then a little light bulb went off and said, well, maybe I should just do that. Mm. And I think a similar thing, just going out on Capitol Hill and visiting friends. And I have friends who own bars in Capitol Hill. I'd be up there and realize that there wasn't really pizza I wanted to eat.
And for Brandon, I know it. This whole process involved an incredible nerding out on pizza, like years long research.
And yeah, I think actually
cool. How do you
one
nerd
of the
out?
First times I met you was at an art opening at Western Bridge, and I nerded out on pizza for like an hour.
Yeah.
Can you give me the shorter version?
No,
of
he can't.
Can you give
no.
me a mini pizza nerd out?
I grew up eating pizza all the time, and when I moved away from the New York, New Jersey area, I hadn't realized how much I would miss eating pizza all the time and miss the care that people and the dedication people put into pizza. So I just started doing experimenting and tasting a bunch of doughs all around the country and essentially going to all the famous places in the country and the world and then picking my favorite parts of each of them and combining them together.
Painstakingly recreating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lovingly.
It was all inspired. I went to music school, and there's a great composition teacher named Nadia Boulanger who taught a bunch of famous composers. And she would tell you if you're going to write a piece for violin that you listen to every piece for violin ever made and get all of your favorite parts from all of them and then write a piece that just copies all those.
Uh-huh.
And then that's like the baseline to even start
yeah.
writing the piece for violin. So I did a similar thing for pizza.
And
really?
As someone who eats food in Seattle, this is the kind of thing I think we want to see. We don't want to see people doing research and focus groups and deciding from that what a neighborhood needs. We want food that comes from the heart and is driven by someone's perhaps bizarrely intense interest in in one kind of food.
Well, are you finding that more people and more money is equaling better food in the Seattle area? Or not so much?
I would almost say the opposite.
Really? Why?
Because in the short term, there's major consistency issues because there aren't enough people to cook the food. So owners are working too hard, burnt out, because they're filling in for cooks that they're not able to hire.
Yeah, this gets us into minimum wage. How can there be a labor shortage when the minimum wage has risen to $15? How's that working?
There's a nationwide labor shortage for restaurants. Workers
for many reasons, yeah.
Yeah, just a variety of economic pressures. And
can you just in the Seattle area,
in
what
Seattle
are those? What's the bullet list?
We have 1,000 people or more moving here every week.
Yeah,
and almost all of them have jobs.
Hmm.
So, and then our housing is getting expensive. So lots of young artsy type people and musicians who would normally work in restaurants are actually moving to LA and Portland or New York or. Where do you say?
Tacoma.
Yeah, Tacoma. Yeah. So people are getting priced out. Immigration is a major issue. There used to be tons of immigrants who worked in restaurants, and he who shall not be named has affected immigration policies and attitudes towards that. So there's less immigrants I can hire. There's less, transportation's a major issue, because it's, you can't live in a, or it's much more difficult to live in a cheap area than you have to drive an hour and a half through traffic and then pay for parking just to work at a job that doesn't pay enough to make that worth it.
Yeah. So it sounds like wages need to go up in the restaurant industry.
They do need to go up.
They're
already up, but that means prices have to go up as well.
Is that happening too?
That's more difficult when there's too much competition. So when you have too many restaurants, it's very hard to just be the more expensive one, yet you're going to have to be the more expensive one if you're going to pay for the higher wages. So that's what most people I know who are in the restaurant industry are scared of. In order to actually keep your businesses staffed, you're going to have to pay people more, which is great, and they deserve to be paid more, but then you have to raise prices, which is scary to do in an already competitive market.
Starting salaries in Seattle in the restaurant industry are, in general, already above minimum wage.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't.
It took me 2 months to hire somebody that was already $2 above minimum wage.
And one thing.
Or $2 above the $15 minimum wage, we're not even up to yet.
All that being said, I mean, we were talking about the possibility of a bubble. One fact that people seem to be responding to in my story is that you always hear that half of all restaurants fail within the first year. That's just sort of this.
Yeah, I always thought that.
Well, it's
just made up, right?
Definitely not true. And the Seattle survival rate for restaurants at 1 year has been hovering around 87%. So we're not seeing the closures, but at the same time, everyone in the industry is extremely uneasy and everything seems completely unpredictable.
But part of that is, like, if I decided that my Capitol Hill place was going to go out of business, I couldn't make it work today, it would still be there for 3 to 5 years because I have to pay off all the loans. So I would continue to keep it even if it lost $10,000 or $20,000 a year. And then I would close it 5 years from now because it's very difficult to just close a place because you have investors and you have bank loans to pay off. So some of the places that might be closing, you wouldn't necessarily know.
One restaurant group, notably Huxley Wallace in South Lake Union, chose to close 3 places rather than keep them open and running them at more of a loss.
Yeah, because I guess you can lose more money than even the cost of the rent, which is frightening too.
So in our last couple of minutes, Brandon and Bethany, let's help out the listener. What do you recommend we do to eat better in this town?
I think people really need to support the restaurants that they love and the chefs who they feel are doing great work. And
but there's so many new restaurants.
I know. And I guess try them out as you can.
I'm quitting my job, by the way. It's been great to be on KUOW for all these years, but I'm devoting myself full time to restaurant eating. I'll be stealing a lot of food if that's okay.
You would have to devote yourself more than full time.
Yes.
Like, I need a clone at this point.
I haven't even heard of most. Some of these places go out of business before I've even heard of them.
Yeah.
Because so many places are opening.
So I'm sorry, I changed back to listeners. We just have a minute or so left. So support your favorite places.
Don't try them all.
You can't unless you are a clone. Support the ones you love.
And support the longstanding places where people are doing beautiful work and working hard. It's hard out there.
And Brandon, be understanding as people are going to have to raise the prices.
Yes, definitely. And be understanding if your service is a little odd. I mean, it is hard. People are working really hard.
Yeah, people are overworked, and most of the people I'm able to hire have no experience. So there's a lot of training. And long term, it's great. It's an awesome problem to have in a city where there's almost no unemployment. But it also means that there might not be as much grace or consistency in your service or food quality right away.
All right. Think of it as a dining adventure. That's Brandon Pettit, owns Delancey in Ballard, Dino's Tomato Pie in Capitol Hill. Bethany Jean Clement writes about our city's food and restaurant scene for the Seattle Times, and what a scene it is. Thanks so much for coming in and capturing what it's really like these days. Amazing.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed this. KUOW is The Record, coming right back. Welcome back to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle's light rail cars are getting crowded. I get on at Westlake now so I can find an open seat. I sit in the rear car so when I get off, I beat the crowds to the escalator. And this is a real thing. Sound Transit CEO Peter Rogoff says there are 26% more riders than last year.
And it gives us a lot of optimism as we, you know, we're under construction up to Northgate. We're under construction over to the east side. When we open up those services, ridership is just going to spike again.
Will our train ridership extend all the way to Canada? Yesterday, Washington Governor Jay Inslee went before the British Columbia legislature and called for high-speed rail between Seattle and Vancouver, maybe south of here, too. Here with the story is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Bill. This is so exciting. You could get from Vancouver to Seattle in an hour.
Yeah.
On a high-speed rail line. Like, you can't get from Vancouver to most of its suburbs in an hour, never mind all the way to Seattle. So that's the exciting part, and the governor certainly got everyone's attention with that one-hour travel time.
Yes, at least 400 kilometers an hour, which I'm trying to make the conversion real quick. It's fast.
Now, there's a couple of wrinkles. Uh-huh. Well, first of all, the Premier of British Columbia, John Horgan, pointed out that that's not net travel time. You'd have to deal with the hour-long wait at the border to get your passport checked.
Not a high-speed process.
Right?
Yeah, right.
So obviously, Customs and Immigration in the two countries would have to cooperate to do the inspections and checking online while the train's running, or else you can forget about it. It ain't going to be a one-hour travel time.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, I don't know what the rail lines are like in Washington State, but there would have to be a huge rebuild and relocation of the train line that comes into British Columbia, because right now it goes right along the waterfront of a waterfront community, White Rock, a very twisty, windy, residential areas. If you're going to go for the kind of high-speed train lines you see in places like France and Japan, it has to be grade separation, has to be straight line through farmland or something like that. And so there's a huge rebuilding project, which, of course, would be beset by zoning requirements and local environmental regulation and everything else. So I don't know whether they could clear all those obstacles and get a straight run from Seattle to Vancouver. That would be an onerous construction project.
And what would be the upsides of this big project? What's the reason?
Well, you know, if you look down the road and assume that air travel is going to become more expensive and people aren't going to be taking planes because of greenhouse gas emissions and jet fuel, if you assume that they're going to try to make it much more expensive to fly between cities and encourage people to take other alternatives, then it starts to make sense. You go, well, you know, instead of flying from Vancouver to Seattle or to Portland, you'd skip all the lineups at the airport and you'd go straight on a train. You can see the argument. The cost, Californians, as you know, are building one of these lines right now between San Francisco and Los Angeles, sort of building it. A lot of legal battles over it, but they have started construction. They priced it down there. The running cost at the moment is about $80 million a mile. So if you could get a fairly straight line from Vancouver to Seattle that paralleled the freeway, that's about 120 miles, figure $10 to $15 billion. You'd have to have a bond issue to finance it. Government would probably step in. You'd have to price the fares accordingly, and you'd have to make sure that it was cheaper than air travel, or at least faster. So I can see it in decades. I can't see it happening right away. There's too many obstacles to doing it. We've had a struggle, Bill, in the last couple of years just establishing a float plane service between Vancouver Harbor and Lake Union. It's coming on. I think they've finally cleared all the regulatory hurdles, but even that took a couple of years to get it approved. So there's a lot of legal and regulatory obstacles to making one of these things happen.
By the way, Vaughn, this was the first Washington governor to address the BC legislature in more than 30 years. What caught your ear?
Yeah, the last governor here was John Spellman. Remember him?
I do.
After Dixie Lee Ray, before Booth Gardner,
mm-hmm.
you know, for people who have the trading cards for Washington State governors.
Mm-hmm.
What really jumped out at me, before Donald Trump came along, I cannot imagine an American state governor coming to another country and showing such disdain for the President of the United States. I mean, he was quite sincere. His comments were very well received, but in a 15-minute speech, Governor Inslee took at least three distinctive runs at Donald Trump, assured Canadians not to worry about who's in the White House. We're still friends. We can still work together on climate action and immigration and refugee policy. I mean, you know the situation down there better than I do, but I was quite taken aback to hear how strong he was in a foreign country about your president.
And finally, we have a Washington state leader who does not give you poop about your sewage treatment.
It was great.
That was news up there.
Man, you people are patient. The governor thanked British Columbia for starting to build a sewage treatment plant in Victoria. In fact, he sailed right past it when he came into the harbor on the Coho from Port Angeles. He said he could see the site. He's glad we're finally doing it. And he was nice enough not to say that it's 10 years after we promised it would be up and running. We're finally doing it. And he thanked us for it. And I'll give him credit for patience and good grace.
Governor Jay Inslee speaking before the British Columbia legislature there. And in about 3 weeks here, Governor Inslee is going to release the results of a study into that cross-border high-speed rail. So we'll keep talking about this one. Vaughn Palmer telling you, don't expect this anytime soon. Vaughn from Vancouver Sun, always good to talk with you. Thank you.
Good to talk to you, Bill. Bye-bye.
It's The Record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle, news and information. The former bass player for Nirvana is doing a different kind of gig these days down on the Grange in Trump country, and we're going to talk to him in just a moment. On Twitter, at KUOW is where the conversation is right now. I'm Bill Radke. This weekend at the Sunset Tavern in Ballard, you can see a promising local band called Giants in the Trees. They're out of Wakayakum County in southwest Washington, rural, red state, Trump-voting America. The bass player is with us, Chris Novoselic. Welcome to KUOW.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
How did you get to Wakayakum County, Chris?
Well, I've been here for over 25 years, and about a little over 25 years ago, I was in this band called Nirvana, and we released this record called Nevermind, which was really successful, and it allowed me to buy the property I live on. So thanks, everybody, for buying Nirvana Records.
That's nice of you. You're welcome. I did that. You owe me. How did you form your band? Do they all live in Wakayakum?
Yeah, we're all Wakayakum County people. It's hard to find good musicians living way out here in the sticks. And I was at a Grange meeting, and some new folks showed up, and we started talking music. And then some guitars came out, accordion came out, and it seemed like we made some wonderful music together. And so we scheduled a jam session, and we started playing music, and a band was born.
Do you mind if I ask what were you doing at a Grange meeting? You should probably tell listeners what a Grange meeting is.
Well, a Grange meeting is like a rural fraternity group, like a social club, basically. And the Grange has been active in Washington State since 1889. It was formed in 1867, and it's advocated for rural issues.
Okay, rural issue advocacy group. Band members meet. Chris Novoselic on bass. The band is Giants in the Trees, and your debut single is Sasquatch. So you have Sasquatch, you have Chris Novoselic, you have music video with Chris Novoselic in a forest. Is this Northwestern music?
It's oozing with Northwestern music because we are Giants in the Trees. We live in the trees. We also collaborate with Robert Michael Pyle, who is a renowned expert on Bigfoot lore and has
really?
And has written about it. We're believers. Yeah, we believe it could happen. There could be a Sasquatch, Bigfoot out there. We're constantly looking out, and so we wrote this song in homage of that vision and that faith.
Are you suggesting we haven't found Sasquatch because he lives in the trees? He's a giant in the trees?
I know, we were looking at the ground.
So you're kind of joking about, how did you say, super duper Northwest or something? But I do wonder if there's a Northwest sound running through you, or if there's even any such a thing. Maybe Nirvana and giants in the trees would happen anywhere.
I don't know. You know, I was on social media, and then there was like, what is the most famous band in your state? And it was like clickbait, right? And so I guess if you're in, I don't know, Iowa, who's going to come up? But in Washington State, I think that would be really tough. Like, who's the most famous band out of Washington? You tell me.
I don't think it's tough. I think I'm talking to the bass player, no?
Oh, really? You think Nirvana's the most famous band?
Who else?
Well, people like tell me they travel to India in these far-flung places, and then they have like Nirvana, see Nirvana shirts.
Yeah, I would think.
Yeah, so I don't know. We're universal, but you know, there's so many other bands. Where do I start?
Well, you made a name for yourself, sir. You might fill the Sunset Tavern in Ballard, which is where you're playing this weekend. What do you think of modern Seattle versus early 90s Seattle? Some people say we've lost our soul up here.
I don't think Seattle's lost its soul. I think there's a lot of challenges with Seattle, with just all the pressure of being a very financially successful city. But you know, I drive through Seattle and I'll see some new building, and then I can't remember what was there. And I'll be riding with somebody and say, do you remember what was there? And like, no. So that's something about the transformation, just moving forward. There's a lot of progressive people who are into urban density because it's better than sprawl, and that people living in a walkable, livable city is ultimately a better society, and it's better for conserving resources and could be a better standard of life.
Well, Chris Novoselic, enjoy the Sunset Tavern this weekend and enjoy the private plane flight back to Wakayakum County.
I'm the pilot, but I'm not going to fly because it's probably going to be bad weather.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Chris Novoselic, grounded, and maybe you'll play a special secret show and pop up somewhere. Who knows? I can't promise. Good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
And this is Giants in the Trees, Chris Novoselic and band on KOW Seattle. I'm grateful to him for the time, and we're going to talk gratitude even when it's difficult coming up here on the day before Thanksgiving. Stay tuned. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. I don't like mashed potatoes, but tomorrow at my sister's Thanksgiving dinner, when someone offers me the potatoes, I'm going to say thank you. I'm grateful for the offer. I'm grateful for my sister. I'm grateful there's a holiday with the word thanks in it. But I didn't realize what gratitude can do until I learned about my next guest. Dr. Tanmeet Sethi runs the Integrative Medicine Program at Swedish Family Medicine in Seattle. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And by the way, you did not used to like the words thank you.
No, they just, you know, they sometimes feel empty. You're not sure if people want to say it or have to say it. And you spend your childhood being told to say it all the time, even if you don't want to.
Right, that's familiar. And you say that gratitude is medicine. You are an integrative physician. What do you mean gratitude is medicine?
Yeah, medicine is anything that helps us feel better or helps us heal. And all too often, medicine is only construed as something that we take out of a bottle. And gratitude is one of those powerful medicines that doesn't come in a bottle. It's even better. It's with you all the time. It's accessible to you. And if you use it intentionally, you can really improve your well-being, your mood, your health in general. There are numerous studies to show how people feel better when they practice gratitude. So it's a powerful tool and a powerful medicine if people really can view it that way.
Can you give an example of how gratitude works physically in the body?
Yeah. You know, there are numerous studies to show that if we practice gratitude, we sleep better, we feel better, our moods are better, and our immune systems are actually stronger. And it's actually been shown in the brain that gratitude increases the release of dopamine, which you may know is a very important neurotransmitter to make us feel better. So there's real biochemistry and physiology to the practice of gratitude.
Well, it's easy to be grateful for good stuff, even mashed potatoes. but why should you talk about how we should be grateful, especially when things go wrong?
Right. So it's really beautiful to be grateful for all the things that go right in our lives. It's a way to recognize how lucky we are and to recognize the beauty that surrounds us. To really understand how gratitude can be a powerful medicine, we need to apply it to all parts of our lives, not just when things are going right. So I know it's a hard way to look at it, and I always have at least one person after I give a talk on gratitude tell me that they're not sure they believe me. And I always say, you know, just try it. You don't have to believe me. You just can try it and see what you think for yourself.
And you don't just mean something went wrong, but I'm grateful because it could have been worse. You don't just mean that.
Right. Actually, there was a good study to show that gratitude really is more powerful when it's actual gratitude for what you have, whether it be challenging or beautiful, not for what you don't have. So not the gratitude that you don't have cancer, but the gratitude for what you do have in your life.
Well, there's an example. I have cancer. Why in the world and how would I be grateful for that?
Right. You know, what first people need to understand is that it's not immediately understandable. You don't start by looking at what you have and say, thank you, I'm so glad I have cancer. As you know, I went through that with my son who has a degenerative and fatal disease. And it wasn't as if I started with thank you, and just went off feeling better. It's more that gratitude really is about being thank you for what's happening to us right now in the present moment. And when we do that, we shed resistance to what's happening. You can imagine whenever anything, or you probably know when anything goes wrong in your life, we fight it. Our first instinct is, I wish it weren't going this way. I wish this wasn't happening. And that resistance actually adds to our suffering. Whereas gratitude really is about accepting, being grateful for this moment as it is. And when we do that, we shed that resistance. And when we shed that resistance, we decrease our suffering. And so it's not that you have to believe the cancer is good for you. It's that the gratitude is that you are here right now and that this is your life and that you're accepting it as it is.
Will you please tell us more about your son? When you describe this in your TED Talk, I have this vivid picture, in my mind anyway, of you in a dimly lit room, kneeling or sitting next to your son's bed. Can you really help us understand what gratitude looked like for you in those moments?
Yeah. When you heard that talk, you heard me say I didn't believe it. I thought it was ridiculous. And but I was desperate. You know, there wasn't anything else helping me feel better about what was happening. And I literally laid in that dark room with him night after night saying thank you and finding things to say thank you for. So you heard me. I said, thank you for this life. Thank you for being with me. Whatever I could think of that could feel authentic to me at that moment. And slowly the thank yous helped me shed what I was fighting, which was that I didn't want this to be happening. Now, I mean, who wants anything bad to happen? That's understandable. But the fact is, it's happening. And so the gratitude really helped me accept what was happening to him and in turn what was happening to me as a mother. And that really shifted my whole life in a very powerful way. So it takes time and it takes practice. The gratitude for challenge is not an easy one. I'm not even trying to act like it is, but it sure is a worthwhile one. It is the reason that I walk around much more blissful, if you can believe it, than I did before this happened to me.
You used a couple words there, Tanmeet, gratitude and acceptance. Maybe I could understand that this is terrible, but, you know, my brother took his life. That, you know, this is awful, but I think even in the moment I could imagine accepting it because this is real. This is what's happening. But why grateful?
Yeah. I can't answer why grateful for you. So that's all different for each of us. That's the magic of this medicine, is it's quite individualized. What I can share is, you know, what happened for me and what I see happen for patients as well, is that the gratitude comes when we shed the resistance. Then we can see the gratitude. It's really hard to see it when we're fighting it. So for example, my gratitude around my son is that he has taught me to live my life to the fullest. He has taught me that life is much more than what I thought it was. It's not about achievement. It's not about him getting married or going to college. It's about the way he lives every day. And in turn, it's about how I live every day. How am I going to make this day special right in front of me? Not waiting for a new one, this one. He's taught me that connecting to others is powerful. So people are often, I have a foundation through which I raise money for research for his disease. And the way that people connect and give with their hearts touches me deeply. I would never see that without him. I would never experience that so personally. I see people in suffering like you who have lost a brother, or other people who are suffering, and my ability to connect to them is far more powerful than it had been because my heart is open to that. I don't know if that's making it clear, but what I'm saying is that my gratitude is actually bountiful around my son, but I couldn't see any of that because I was so stuck in the suffering. Let me make it clear. It doesn't mean I'm not sad. It doesn't mean I don't feel so sad and suffer. Watching him decline is quite difficult. But what it means is that amidst that suffering, gratitude makes meaning out of it. I really find powerful ways to live this life amidst the suffering. And so it seems vague. I know, believe me, this is not an easy idea to sell, but it's one that's so worth it because your life just transforms.
In fact, doctor, you even said that you spent more time with your son as you began to feel grateful for your and his situation, that you had kind of been pushing him away, I think you said.
Yeah. You know, it is painful to be with him and to, you know, to face what was happening. I think we all want to push away pain. You know, I think that's a pretty human trait. And the more and more I practiced gratitude, the more I wanted more of that secret juice sauce that was making my life so much better. I tell my patients all the time, we don't need any self-help books on how to be negative. Let me tell you, we've got it down. Gratitude allows us to really look for the beauty, to look for the positive, to look for the miracles that stand right in front of us. And so the more you do that, the more you want it. It's amazing.
Doctor, as I've said, I appreciate all of this. I found your talk very powerful, and that's why I reached out to you. I do want to ask some difficult questions about situations where being grateful seems like accepting injustice. Are you saying we could be grateful for oppression or murder? You get the idea.
Yeah, these are really difficult questions. No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that being grateful for where you are right now allows you to actually see things more clearly, and then fighting injustice is actually easier. So you can think more clearly when your mind is less cluttered with all the bad. So we'll just take an example, oppression, which is unfortunately vastly present in our lives right now, just the starkness of it. It's always been there, but it's very stark. And I feel like I could never be grateful that people are being oppressed. What I can be grateful for is that I can be part of a community that fights that, You look at someone like Nelson Mandela, who spent decades in jail, and really he talks about gratitude and how powerful it is that he can feel grateful for what he has done, for what people have done because of his fight. That is gratitude. It really is a powerful tool to see more clearly.
I also found it interesting and hopeful that you find gratitude is a pain reliever emotionally, yes, and even physically. How does that work?
Well, you know, it can work in ways that when we're in so much pain, the reaction to that pain also includes tensing up to the pain. So the pain occurs, maybe it's a constant pain that happens often for you. There's a physical reaction that we can have, a tensing of our muscles, a tensing of our emotions even against the pain, thinking, oh, here it is again. Oh, I wish it weren't here. I really don't want it. How long is it going to last? What is it going to be like this time? And the gratitude allows us to just say thank you. You don't even have to say thank you to the pain. You could just say thank you. And just sit and take some deep breaths and really breathe through the pain and just thank you for being here. Thank you that I'm here. And feel your body tensing less and see what happens. See what happens to the pain.
My doctors have talked about that with issues I've had with back pain. They'll talk about, well, then you start, as you say, tensing and resisting, and you start moving this way, and that affects that. And I thought, oh, yeah, I'm not sure if I totally get it, but the idea of your mental attitude toward pain can even affect the way you perceive the pain level.
Yes. Yes, that's been made pretty clear. So there's so much power we have, so much medicine that doesn't come in a bottle that we can use. And really, over time, it changes your framework. You know, I started a whole gratitude blog after that talk to really weekly give, you know, sort of pieces and nuggets of how to use gratitude in a more consistent daily way. Because what happens is that when you start really gratefully living, everything changes. The perspective changes on everything.
So will you sum up that gratitude practice? How can I stay grateful or become more grateful?
Yeah. For one, you know, you can start by just kind of boosting yourself into it by doing a gratitude practice for a month where you really write down two things every day that you're grateful for at the end of the day, and they can never be the same thing. So you kind of use that month to really get yourself into the gratitude mood, the gratitude muscle. And then, you know, after that, it could be that you continue with really sharing that. My family and I share what we call gratefuls every day at dinner, where we say one thing we're grateful for that day. We have a gratitude jar in our house where you can write down things you're grateful for any time and put in the jar, and then we take them out at random times to read just to remind us that there are so many things to be grateful for. And then really the fundamental shift happens when you start looking at the gratitude and everything. So that shift happens after you practice those simple tools. Then you start realizing that you're looking at everything differently. So this weekend, I was with a cousin dying of brain cancer, and so many people said, you know, I'm so sorry that you had to do that. And I said, I'm grateful for the gift to have been with him at such a time. Do you see how it just everything shifts instead of it being that was such a sad weekend? It was sad, but what I was grateful for was the gift of being with him.
Yeah, we do gratitude at dinner time as well. And my child asked me about why I had that attitude. And I told her a story of myself as a helpless newborn with people helping me immediately and me benefiting from, I started with a heart monitor and, you know, heat lamps. And then, of course, I include my mother. And then it just widens out and it's rainfall and it's everything. So to me, this stuff is not woo. It's very... It's something that it does change you when you start looking at all the stuff that rains down on you, not in a Pollyannish way, but just a grateful way.
Wow, you've got this down, Bill. You need a guest blog for me.
All right, you and I will go out as a team.
Yeah, exactly.
Dr. Tanmeet Sethi runs the Integrative Medicine Program at the Swedish Cherry Hill Family Medicine in Seattle. It's been great to talk with you. Let's do this again.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Bill. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Yeah, right. Happy Thanksgiving, too. Thanks for spending this hour with us. That was Dr. Tanmeet Sethi. She writes a weekly gratitude blog, which we're sharing with you right now on Twitter. Her latest post is how impossible it is to write about gratitude on Thanksgiving, but she manages it. We asked on Facebook what you're grateful for. Cal says we have the most fair and just system of governance in the world, despite those in constant complain mode. And Lisa says, despite everything life has thrown at me the last 3 years, I have wonderful people in my life who made me laugh when I wanted to cry, gave me strength when I felt weak, and loved me for the goof that lives inside me. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle, all put together by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel. I'm Bill Radke. Again, thanks for listening. Have a great holiday.